November 12, 1988. Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. After he is not heard from for over 24 hours, the body of 36-year-old Byron Carr is discovered in the bedroom of his residence. He has been strangled with a towel and stabbed with a kitchen knife, and the words, "I will kill again," are scrawled on the bedroom wall. The evidence suggests that Byron had sex with another man before he was murdered, but even though the perpetrator left DNA behind, attempts to match it to anyone are unsuccessful. Over the years, investigators receive a number of compelling tips, including the name of an accomplice who allegedly helped the killer cover up the crime, but Byron's murder is never solved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be returning to our podcast's home country of Canada to cover a frustrating cold case, the 1988 murder of Byron Carr. A few months ago, The Trail Went Cold reached a milestone in which we managed to cover at least one cold case from all 50 American states, so I made it a goal to eventually do the same thing for every Canadian province and territory. Today, we're going to be exploring our first ever case from Canada's smallest province, Prince Edward Island, and it is considered to be the province's only unsolved homicide in recent times. I also decided to cover this one right now because June just happens to be Pride Month, and the victim's sexual orientation played a big role in how the investigation was handled. Byron Carr was murdered in the bedroom of his residence, and he was essentially outed by his death, as the evidence showed that he had brought another man home and had sex with him before he was killed. This revelation came as a major surprise to many people who knew Byron, because back in Prince Edward Island in 1988, gay and bisexual residents were very closeted about their sexual orientation. The local gay community was not particularly trusting of law enforcement, so it was suspected that people who may have had important information about Byron's murder were reluctant to come forward for fear of outing themselves. Well, over the past 15 years, there has been a renewed effort to solve this crime, and the area's attitudes towards gay people have improved enough that some intriguing new leads have surfaced, though they have yet to result in a resolution. What's particularly frustrating is that the authorities have the killer's DNA and know the identity of an alleged accomplice who may have helped the perpetrator cover up the crime, but this still hasn't been enough to figure out who actually did this. With the amount of evidence available, this is definitely a very solvable crime, so I think this is definitely an ideal time to cover it on this podcast. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early accessed episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the murder of Byron Carr. Our story begins in 1988 in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, which is the capital city of Canada's smallest province and had a population of around 15,000 at that time. Our central figure is 36-year-old Byron Carr, who had spent years working as an English teacher at Montague Regional High School. Even though Byron was popular and well-liked by his students and colleagues, it sounds like his teaching career was in a bit of a holding pattern at this point. Byron had been the chair of the school's yearbook committee, but sometime during the spring, $6,000 which had been collected for the committee went missing. While the money was eventually returned, there was enough friction surrounding the incident that Byron wound up leaving his job at the school. Details about this whole situation are pretty vague, and it's unclear to me if Byron was still employed at the time of his death, as he was living in Charlottetown in a house on Lapthorne Avenue alongside his dog and a boarder who was renting a room from him. On the morning of Saturday, November the 12th, Byron was scheduled to go to his parents' home for a family gathering, as his sister, Maida Fielding, and her husband Walter were visiting from out of town. When Byron failed to show, Maida and Walter decided to go to his house to check on him and arrived at around 11 a.m. Even though the front door was locked, they discovered that the rear door to the kitchen was open, so they went inside. When they entered Byron's bedroom, they were horrified to discover him lying dead on the floor. Byron had been strangled with a towel and stabbed in the abdomen with a long-handled kitchen knife. The Charlottetown Police Service was summoned to the residence and discovered that a haunting message had been scrawled on the bedroom wall in ballpoint pen, which read, quote, "I will kill again." Byron's wallet was missing from the scene, and his dog was still locked inside its kennel. There were also two pieces of evidence left behind which likely belonged to Byron's killer: a pair of socks found inside the kitchen's garbage can, as well as a pair of underwear. It was described as being medium-sized bikini-style underwear, which was a brand from the Canadian department store Zellers, and since it had a 29.5-inch waist size, it was too small to have been worn by Byron. The underwear contained traces of semen belonging to a male donor, which did not match Byron, and the physical evidence would show that Byron had a consensual sexual encounter with another man before he was killed. While Byron had dated women in the past, it turned out that he had a number of gay friends and a sexual interest in men. He had always kept this aspect of his private life a secret, and Brad McConnell, an investigator who eventually took over the case, would later state that Byron was, quote-unquote, outed by his death. The autopsy would show no trace of drugs in Byron's system, and there were no noticeable signs of struggle on his body. His exact cause of death turned out to be strangulation, as he was not stabbed with the kitchen knife until after he was already dead. Investigators put together a timeline of Byron's last known movements and determined that he was likely dead for around 26 to 30 hours before his body was found. On the evening of Thursday, November the 10th, Byron had a candlelight dinner at a local restaurant with a female friend of his before he returned home at around 9:30 p.m. Shortly thereafter, two family friends showed up at Byron's residence and they drank coffee together. They said that Byron received a couple of phone calls while they were there, including one from his mother, where he confirmed that he would be visiting her place on Saturday morning. Byron's friends left at 11:45, but since Friday, November the 11th, was Remembrance Day, this meant that Canada was about to experience a long holiday weekend, so Byron decided to go out bar hopping. Byron joined up with two of his friends, and they went out drinking at three separate bars before they all decided to return to Byron's house for more drinks at 2 a.m. Even though Byron asked his friends to spend the night, one of them had to leave on a trip to Halifax later that morning, so both his friends left at 2:45. However, it appeared that a short time later, Byron exited his house again and climbed into his vehicle, a white 1987 Ford Tempo. Another one of Byron's friends claimed that at around 3 a.m., he was walking towards his home on Sydney Street when Byron pulled up beside him and offered him a ride. Byron then took his friend to his residence, which was about a 5-minute drive from his own house. According to the friend, Byron was heading west when he drove away, but this would turn out to be the last time he was confirmed to be alive. Byron appeared to be heading in the direction of Queen Square, which was known as Charlottetown's quote-unquote gay strip, since it was a popular spot to pick up gay people at the time. In fact, some of Byron's friends would claim that whenever they were out late, he would sometimes head to Queen Square after they parted ways. This led to speculation that Byron might have picked up another man there and brought him back to his house for sex before this person murdered him. Indeed, there was no sign of forced entry at Byron's residence, which suggested that he invited his killer inside. The boarder who rented a room from Byron would also claim that he showed up there at 9 a.m. on the morning of November the 11th and saw Byron's car parked outside. The boarder briefly went into the house to pick up some clothes before leaving on a trip for the long holiday weekend, but since Byron's bedroom door was closed, he never saw his body. But this established that Byron's murder likely took place sometime between 3:30 and 9 a.m. that morning. Needless to say, since Prince Edward Island had the lowest violent crime rate of any Canadian province, and murders in Charlottetown were very uncommon, the crime shocked the city. Since Byron's killer had written the words, "I will kill again," on his bedroom wall, there was fear among the local gay community that someone was targeting them, but no other murders of this nature took place. For many years, the Charlottetown Police Service was very secretive about revealing details about the investigation to the public, and since DNA testing was still in its infancy back in 1988, it would be over a decade before a full DNA profile was collected from the semen found on the underwear at the murder scene. Even though the DNA was added to both national and international databases, it failed to generate a match. Surprisingly, testing would also reveal the presence of a female DNA profile on the underwear. This did not necessarily mean that a woman was involved in the crime, only that the killer may have had a previous sexual encounter with a woman shortly before he killed Byron and was possibly bisexual. However, no match could be found for the female DNA profile either. In September of 2007, Byron's case was formally reopened for a cold case review from the Charlottetown Police Service, and the new lead investigator, Detective Sergeant Brad McConnell, would make a public statement. McConnell said that back in 1988, Charlottetown's gay community pretty much existed, quote-unquote, underground. He always wondered if there were members of the community who knew important information about Byron's murder, but since they did not have much trust in confiding with the police, they were reluctant to come forward for fear of outing themselves. Now that two decades had passed, and attitudes about gay people had become more progressive, McConnell was hoping there might be key witnesses who would be more willing to talk. Indeed, when he took over the investigation, McConnell interviewed a number of people from the city's gay community who had previously been reluctant to speak with the police. McConnell also wanted to publicly confirm that Byron's death was not an accident caused by a sex game gone wrong, and made it clear that whoever killed him made an intentional decision to commit murder. Well, only a few months after McConnell made this announcement, an eyewitness finally came forward and told police about a frightening incident he'd experienced less than 2 months after Byron was killed. The witness said he was a closeted gay man back in 1988 and had picked up another young man near Queen Square before taking him back to his residence. After they had sex, the witness suddenly pulled a knife on him and proceeded to steal his wallet and say he'd, quote-unquote, done this before he fled the scene. Since he did not want to out himself, the witness never reported this incident to the police and did not feel comfortable coming forward until Byron's murder started generating publicity again 2 decades later. The witness underwent hypnosis to help him recall the incident, and he described the assailant as being a white male with auburn hair who appeared to be around 19 years old, and a composite sketch would eventually be created and circulated for him. Around this same time period, another eyewitness came forward with an interesting new sighting of Byron, which took place at around 3:05 a.m. on the morning of November the 11th, 1988, after Byron dropped off his friend on Sydney Street. The witness claimed that he knew Byron personally and saw him sitting inside his Ford Tempo, which was pulled over at the corner of Prince and Richmond Streets near Queen Square. Byron was speaking to a white male riding a bicycle who appeared to be in his early to mid-20s. When Byron drove away, he was heading in the direction of his house, and the cyclist followed behind him. Since it took the witness so long to come forward, police did have some skepticism about his story, but he agreed to take a polygraph and wound up passing. In November of 2013, the Charlottetown Police Service announced that they now had compelling evidence implicating a second man in the crime. While this man was not directly involved in Byron's murder, the killer may have enlisted his help to cover up the crime. In 2008 and 2012, two separate eyewitnesses had come forward and told police that this alleged accomplice had confessed his involvement to them. Even though these two witnesses had no real connection to each other, they both told very similar stories about this confession and shared details that could have only been provided to them by someone with inside knowledge of the crime. The story goes that sometime after the murder took place and before Byron's body was discovered, the killer asked the accomplice to accompany him to Byron's residence in order to retrieve an important piece of evidence he had left behind at the scene, his underwear. It turned out that some of Byron's neighbors had recalled seeing two men behaving suspiciously outside his house at around 8:45 p.m. on the evening of November the 11th, 1988. And at around midnight, they heard the sound of Byron's dog barking. At that point, the dog still would have been locked in its kennel inside the house, but it was apparently very out of character for the dog to bark. Sounds of a vehicle leaving the scene could also be heard at around 2:30 a.m. on the morning of November the 12th, and when Byron's sister Maida arrived at the residence over 8 hours later, the rear kitchen door was left wide open. Obviously, if the killer and his accomplice returned to the murder scene to retrieve the underwear, they had no success finding it, since the underwear was still present when Byron's body was discovered. It's been theorized that this may have compelled them to stage the scene in order to throw off the investigation, which included stabbing Byron in the abdomen with a kitchen knife after he was already dead, stealing his wallet, and writing, "I will kill again," on the bedroom wall. Detective Sergeant McConnell did not believe the handwritten message was a serious threat, stating, quote, "What we see in this crime scene is a display of frustration, some lashing out, and some juvenile behavior," end quote. While the name of this accomplice has never been released publicly, investigators confirmed that he had a violent criminal past, which included the robberies of gay men. Back in 1988, he was 27 years old and believed to be bisexual, and had also been released from a federal prison a short time before Byron's murder took place. He was apparently on a short list of suspects during the early stages of the investigation, though there was no evidence to implicate him at that time, and he wound up passing away in 2003. However, investigators have stated that if the accomplice had still been alive at the time the two investigators came forward with their stories about his alleged confession, he would have been arrested. In addition, handwriting analysis seemed to indicate that it was the accomplice who wrote the message on the wall. It also turned out that the socks found inside the kitchen's garbage can contained a male DNA profile which did not match the DNA of Byron, his killer, or the accomplice. It's been speculated that the DNA belonged to the socks' original owner, but that they were not personally involved in the crime. The killer and his accomplice may have stolen the socks from someone and wore them on their hands to avoid leaving fingerprints at the murder scene before they threw them away. Much like the DNA profiles found in the underwear, there has been no match to the DNA found on the socks. And even though investigators seem to know the identity of the killer's accomplice, they have still been unable to identify the killer himself. However, they have created a criminal profile for him, as they believe he was between 15 to 25 years old when the murder took place, had previous run-ins with the police, and lived a high-risk lifestyle in Charlottetown at that time. In July of 2018, the Charlottetown Police Service received a pair of calls from an unidentified man who left them messages claiming that he had information about Byron Carr's murder. He never left any contact information, and even though the calls were made from a payphone at the Charlottetown Mall, the phone was not covered by any security cameras. While the police sent out a public plea for this man to contact them again, he never did. Now, in regards to the DNA profile left behind by the killer, it has unfortunately deteriorated so much over the years that it cannot be tested with any advanced forensic techniques such as genetic genealogy. However, the DNA has been used to rule out hundreds of potential suspects and can still be tested against existing DNA samples until a match can be made. But this is yet to happen, so Byron Carr's killer continues to remain unidentified. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So this case is often cited as Prince Edward Island's only unsolved murder. That isn't to say that it's the only unsolved murder in the nearly 150-year history of the province, and of course, PEI still has its fair share of unsolved missing persons cases which possibly ended in foul play. But this is their only cold case homicide of recent times which is still being actively investigated. I mentioned during the intro that I thought this was an appropriate cold case to cover during Pride Month, because the crime may have been solved a long time ago if the area's attitude towards gay people had been different. During online discussions about this case, I've seen a number of comments from people who said they lived in Prince Edward Island during the 1980s and confirmed that coming out of the closet as gay or bisexual was just one of those things you did not do back then. I found a Reddit thread containing an amusing comment from a poster named Randy F. McDonald, who stated, quote, "Speaking as a Prince Edward Islander who was alive at the time, if only 8 years old when the murder happened, the circumlocutions of the island newspapers in trying to explain the only murder in the province without actually explaining what had happened are almost funny." End quote. Indeed, It sounds like Byron Carr gave off the outward impression of being a straight male, since he did have relationships with women, but only a select group of people knew about his interest in men. And given that he had worked as a teacher, you can totally understand why he would have remained in the closet, since a secret like that could have destroyed his career. It sounds like Charlottetown's gay community did not exactly have the most trusting relationship with the police at that time, which is why certain witnesses who might have had important pieces of information were reluctant to come forward. Even if they had no involvement in Byron's murder, they were very concerned about the ramification of outing themselves. As a prime example, there's the witness who had a knife pulled on him and was robbed by another man after they had sex. For all we know, he could have had an encounter with Byron's killer, but this was just not a time period where a closeted gay man would have felt comfortable sharing a story like that with law enforcement. The situation is a bit reminiscent of a case involving a serial killer known as the Doodler, who murdered a number of gay men in San Francisco during the mid-1970s. The investigation reached the point where police were certain they had identified the killer, but he was never arrested because the surviving victims did not want to out themselves by testifying against him in court. So officially, the case is still unsolved, and the Doodler has never been charged. While losing Byron was traumatic enough, it sounds like his family had to deal with additional grief once details of his private life became public. Byron's brother, Scott Carr, shared a story about how he and his mother were once standing in line at a store together and overheard a stranger discussing Byron's murder and saying that he, quote-unquote, got what he deserved. If you perform a search on YouTube, you'll find a video titled Who Killed Byron Carr, which is an episode of a Canadian news magazine program produced sometime in 1993 or 1994. The Charlottetown Police Service declined to participate in the episode, and there's a section when the police chief is shown avoiding the cameras when an attempt is made to interview him. While the police's official stance was that they didn't want to talk about the case publicly in order to avoid compromising the investigation, the gay community had their suspicions that indifference or homophobia may have played a role in the case remaining cold for years. I mean, I can understand DNA testing not immediately taking place since that wasn't a common practice back in 1988, but it is a bit surprising that the police did not attempt to collect a full DNA profile from the evidence until 2001. However, it seems like the investigation was given new life when Detective Sergeant Brad McConnell took over the case in 2007. McConnell has had a long and distinguished career in law enforcement, and he actually became police chief of Charlottetown last year, and it sounds like he went out of his way to create a more progressive atmosphere where the gay community would feel comfortable talking to the police. Of course, this paved the way to a number of promising leads from witnesses who finally came forward, but it still hasn't led to Byron's killer being identified. Now, most contemporary media accounts of this case refer to Byron as a former teacher who was well-liked and popular, but the aforementioned Who Killed Byron Carr episode is the only source I've found which mentions Byron leaving his job in the months prior to his murder. As you recall, Byron was chair of his school's yearbook committee until $6,000 which had been raised for them went missing, and while the details of what actually happened are pretty murky, the implication is that Byron took the money and subsequently returned it before he resigned from his teaching position. It's never mentioned if Byron obtained another job before he was killed, but it sounds like he spent much of this time period partying and hanging out in bars with friends, and likely had a number of secret gay hookups with other men. I get the impression that it was very out of character for Byron to steal $6,000, and no one really knows why he would have done something like that, but I have to wonder if being in the closet was causing great strain on him. By all accounts, being openly gay or bisexual was just something that was not done in Prince Edward Island back then, and if a teacher was outed, I'm sure that would have destroyed their career. So perhaps stealing the money was a self-destructive act on Byron's part to relieve himself of the burden of being a closeted teacher, which is why he spent the next several months living a lifestyle of embracing his interest in other men. I also wanted to mention that the Who Killed Byron Carr episode featured audio from an anonymous informant who claimed that in the year prior to his death, Byron had invited him to sex parties he supposedly held at his house, which involved both men and women. While this informant said that he never personally attended any of these parties, he heard that photographs and videos were taken there, and that a prominent police official was once in attendance. I think this was supposed to plant the seeds that a cover-up was taking place, and the police did not want the case to be solved because they had a potentially scandalous connection to what happened. However, since the investigation was reopened in 2007, I have not heard one thing about these so-called sex parties, and I'm really skeptical that this informant's story is even true. It sounds like nothing more than sensationalistic conspiracy theory nonsense, and I think the actual truth about what happened is a lot more simple. Byron went out and picked up another man and brought him back to his house for sex, but this person wound up killing him. So after all these years, the investigation seems to have collected quite a few pieces of the puzzle, but not enough to put everything together and conclusively identify Byron's killer. The police have quite a bit of physical evidence, but listing it all off reads like an exercise in frustration. We have a male DNA profile which likely belonged to Byron's killer, but it doesn't match anyone in the official databases. As you all know, during the past few years, genetic genealogy has become such an important tool for solving cold cases and has often linked DNA evidence to a suspect who never even popped up on the radar before. But in this particular case, the available DNA has deteriorated so much that advanced forensic genealogy is not an option. While police have been unable to identify the killer, they do believe they've identified an accomplice who helped the perpetrator cover up the murder, but he died 2 decades ago, and it doesn't sound like any of his known associates can be linked to the crime. We have a female DNA profile on the killer's underwear, which likely belonged to a previous sexual partner he had, but it hasn't been matched to anyone, even though figuring out this woman's identity could play a huge role in helping identify the killer. And if that wasn't enough, we have an additional male DNA profile found in the socks that were disposed of in the kitchen garbage can, and it does not match the killer's DNA or the DNA of the alleged accomplice. It's unlikely that this person was involved in the crime, as the killer or his accomplice likely stole the socks from him and wore them on their hands to avoid leaving fingerprints. But once again, the DNA has never been matched to anyone, even though identifying this person could potentially help police figure out who the killer was. Now, even though the DNA evidence cannot be used for anything advanced like genetic genealogy, it can still be compared to existing DNA samples for potential suspects. There has been speculation that Byron personally knew his killer, but DNA has been collected from hundreds of individuals and there's been no match yet, so it's possible that the perpetrator was a complete stranger whom Byron met for the first time that night. The DNA has also failed to match anyone in any of the national or international databases, so if the killer has ever been incarcerated for another crime, their DNA was likely never collected. For years, one potential suspect was a man named Peter Dale McDonald, who is currently incarcerated for the murders of a man named James Campbell and a woman named Michelle Charette, and is suspected of being a potential serial killer responsible for additional murders. Around the time period Byron was killed, McDonald was a recent parolee living in Prince Edward Island who violated his parole when he left the island without permission. In fact, during the Who Killed Byron Carr episode, they share a rumor that police have a pretty good idea who the killer is, but lack the evidence to make an arrest, and I have to wonder if they were referring to McDonald. But DNA testing eventually ruled McDonald out as being the perpetrator, and it would be established that he was in Montreal on the date Byron was killed. Many of you are probably familiar with Bruce MacArthur, a serial killer who is serving a life sentence in prison for murdering 8 men, many of them gay or bisexual, in Toronto from 2010 until 2017. Naturally, there's been speculation that MacArthur might have had additional victims we don't know about yet, and I've seen his name pop up in discussions about Byron Carr's murder. However, as a lifelong Ontario resident, there's nothing that places MacArthur in Prince Edward Island in 1988, and since they have his DNA on file, I would not be surprised if they've already compared it to the DNA evidence in this case and ruled him out. So even though a message was left at Byron's murder scene which read, "I will kill again," it's very possible that this person never actually did kill again, which is why they managed to remain completely off the radar for nearly 34 years. So let's examine the timeline on the night Byron's murder took place. We know that he spent most of the evening hanging out with friends and bar hopping, and that two of his friends went to his house to have a drink with them after 2 a.m. They said that Byron seemed to really want them to spend the night, which they found a bit unusual, but since they were unable to do so, the two friends left at around 2:45. The next confirmed sighting of Byron is when he was driving down Sydney Street approximately 15 minutes later and saw another one of his friends walking, so he offered him a lift and drove him home. It's unclear why Byron decided to leave his house again and was out driving, but it's been theorized that he was heading towards Queen Square, aka the gay strip, in order to pick up a male companion. The way Byron was acting towards his friends seemed to indicate that he did not want to spend the night alone, so this may have compelled him to hop into his car and go cruising for companionship. It was probably just pure chance that he saw this other friend and decided to give him a lift home, but shortly thereafter, he likely picked someone else up and took him back to his residence. While police did not learn about this story until 2 decades after the fact, there was an eyewitness who claimed he saw Byron speaking to a cyclist that proceeded to follow Byron when he drove away, so if this eyewitness's account is accurate, then they may have headed back to Byron's house and this cyclist was the killer. Now, the police have not shared any specific details, but from what they've seen of the physical evidence, they were certain that Byron did have consensual sex with the man who killed him and was not sexually assaulted. Since Byron was strangled with a towel, there were rumors that his death was a result of a sex game gone wrong, such as an act of erotic asphyxiation, where cutting off the supply of oxygen to one's brain is used to achieve sexual pleasure. However, investigators have since made it very clear that the evidence shows that Byron's death was an intentional act of murder and not an accident. We have the account from the witness who came forward 2 decades after the fact and claimed that he picked up a young man for sex less than 2 months after Byron's murder, and this guy proceeded to pull a knife on him, steal his wallet, and proclaim that he had, quote-unquote, done this before. Given the circumstances, it's reasonable to assume that this young man was Byron's killer, but why would he murder Byron and then let the other victim live? This makes me wonder, did the perpetrator always plan on killing Byron when he accompanied him back to his residence? Or did something happen which drove him to violence? Well, after committing the murder, the killer supposedly returned to the crime scene with an accomplice the following night in order to recover a key piece of evidence that they never did find. So if the killer and the young man who pulled the knife on the other victim are the same person, perhaps he did not want to draw additional attention to himself by committing another murder. He may have felt that the victim would not report his robbery to the police for fear of outing himself, and if so, his instincts turned out to be correct. But it doesn't sound like robbery was the motive for Byron's murder, since the killer apparently did not take his wallet until after he returned to the scene, possibly to give off the false impression that the crime was a robbery. The details of how the killer and his accomplice staged the murder scene were shared by 2 different witnesses who came forward to police 4 years apart. Even though they were both sharing the accomplice's confession secondhand, the details shared by the witnesses were so similar and accurate to the facts of the crime that investigators believed they were telling the truth. The police also interviewed other individuals who knew the accomplice personally, and they said he was not the type of person to make up stories like that unless he was telling the truth. So it sounds like the act of stabbing Byron with a kitchen knife and writing "I will kill again" on the bedroom wall were not done until nearly 24 hours after he was originally murdered, and they were done for the express purpose of creating misdirection and throwing off the investigation. Brad McConnell has theorized that these acts were done out of frustration because the killer cannot find the pair of underwear he had left behind. And I find that kind of odd, because the police obviously found it, so how well hidden could it have been that the killer and his accomplice were unable to retrieve it? Since there were no signs of forced entry, and the front door was locked when Byron's sister discovered his body on the morning of November the 12th, I'm guessing that Byron invited his killer into the house. After he committed the murder, the killer likely exited through the rear kitchen door and left it unlocked, which is how he was able to re-enter the house the following night. In 2009, the Charlottetown Police Service publicly announced that a local resident named George Smith, who lived on Richmond Street in fairly close proximity to Byron's residence, had his car stolen just hours before the murder was believed to have taken place. Investigators wondered if the murder and the car theft might be related, but after all these years, they were unable to track down George Smith or the original police report of the theft. I haven't seen any further follow-up on this lead, but if the eyewitness account of the young man riding the bicycle is accurate, then I'm not sure if they would have needed to steal a car, or if the theft has any real significance. So obviously, since this alleged accomplice died 2 decades ago, there are a number of unanswered questions about him, but I find it interesting how investigators have stated that if he had still been alive at the time these 2 eyewitnesses came forward, he would have been arrested. They acknowledge that there is no physical evidence placing the accomplice at the murder scene, but I do wonder if they have other corroborating evidence to support these witnesses' stories. It sounds like they do have the accomplice's DNA on file, but have been unable to match it to any of the DNA found at the scene, which means that someone else was responsible for committing the actual murder. Obviously, since the accomplice has never been charged with anything in relation to this crime, I can understand why the police have never released his name publicly, but I have to admit that I'm a bit torn about this. If his name got out there, that might ring some bells for people with important information, such as any criminal associates this man had back in 1988. This is the thing that has always baffled and frustrated me about this crime. The police obviously know a lot of details about the accomplice's life, as they've mentioned that he has a past criminal history and was 27 years old at the time the murder took place, but it does not sound like they've ever uncovered anyone else from his background who matches the DNA evidence or is a likely candidate to be the killer. I mean, the perpetrator entrusted this man to accompany him to a murder scene and help him cover up a crime, so that would seem to indicate a fairly close relationship, yet this doesn't seem to have brought about any promising suspects. And of course, like I mentioned earlier, in addition to the killer's DNA, we have a female DNA profile on the killer's underwear, and a second male DNA profile on a pair of socks found at the scene. Again, it's unlikely that either of these individuals were involved in the crime, but if investigators were able to determine their identities, that's one step closer to figuring out who the killer was. The female DNA would seem to indicate that the perpetrator had sex with a woman a short time before he killed Byron, which is why the criminal profile created for him suggests he was bisexual. For all we know, the killer could have been married or involved in a serious relationship with a woman at that time, while secretly carrying on sexual encounters with other men. This could provide some potential insight on why he snapped and decided to murder Byron. It's been reported that DNA testing has been used to rule out a great deal of potential suspects who had any sort of connection with Byron, but of course, since a DNA profile was not even created until over a decade after the fact, they haven't tracked down and ruled out everyone. After several years, a number of people who knew Byron back in 1988 could have since moved away from the area, or their current whereabouts are unknown. The killer's criminal profile suggests that he was a young man when the crime took place, and Byron may have been 10 to 20 years older than him. For this reason, one of the most prominent theories is that the perpetrator was a student or former student of Byron's. Since Byron was a well-liked teacher and was never accused of doing anything inappropriate with his students, I'm certainly not going to jump to any conclusions or point any fingers at him without evidence. But I will acknowledge that I've always suspected that there was more to the story about the missing $6,000 from Byron's yearbook committee and why he left his teaching job at the school. All that being said, I'm guessing that law enforcement has already looked at the student angle and failed to turn up any potential suspects. Personally, I am still inclined to believe that the killer was a complete stranger that Byron picked up and took home while he was cruising for sex, and this person had no known connection to him. In spite of the "I will kill again" message, it's very possible that Byron's murderer never did kill again. Given how few murders there are on Prince Edward Island, if the killer did harm someone else, they may have traveled elsewhere to do so. But it's also possible that they've somehow gone on to live a normal life and are still doing so today. Over the past 15 years, there have been so many new tips from eyewitnesses which shed additional light on this case, but the one tip which hasn't been thoroughly explored are the messages that the anonymous caller left for the Charlottetown Police Service in July of 2018, where he claimed that he had information about Byron's murder. Since the caller has never made any further attempts to get in touch with the police, we have no idea if these messages were legitimate, but even though Prince Edward Island has gotten more progressive about the LGBTQ community these past three decades, there might still be witnesses who have important information about this case and are still reluctant to come forward for fear of revealing certain aspects of their life, which they would prefer to remain private. But if there are witnesses out there who are continuing to remain silent, I hope they might one day reach the point where they feel comfortable revealing what they know. Even though we still don't have any promising suspects to be the perpetrator, I do consider this to be one of the more solvable cases we featured on The Trail Went Cold, because there is DNA evidence which could be linked to the right person someday. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved murder of Byron Carr, please contact the Charlottetown Police Service at 902-629-4172. That's 902-629-4172. Or you can call Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-TIPS. That's 1-800-222-8255. 8477. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released another joint bonus episode with my friend Charlie from the Crime Lines podcast, in which we discussed a very famous case from Unsolved Mysteries that wound up being solved, the murder of Shannon Moore by her husband, Dave Davis. In addition, I dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spinoff podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another classic case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1994 murder of Matt Flores. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'm also pleased to announce that later this summer, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Westin Park Central Hotel in Dallas, Texas, from August the 27th until the 28th. Myself and many other prominent true crime podcasts will be in attendance, and there will be a bunch of panel sessions, discussions, and live episodes, so in order to purchase tickets, please visit the website truecrimepodcastfestival.com. That's truecrimepodcastfestival.com. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just want to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music here on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.